Hi, I'm Liam O'Rourke, and in this episode we'll be talking about shoot promos, sunny days, hostage situations, and backstage fights. Oh, and red ropes, because that's when you know Vince is fucking serious.
I'm G. John Chase, and you know what? I think Hulk Hogan's been getting some real bad press recently, and I think we need to look at the positives. He's definitely a company guy. No, something else. He's a great husband. Fuck. Okay, he's a great father. He does not have a weird relationship with his daughter. God's sake, this is why I'm 0-3 in these court cases.
Hi, I'm Kieran O'Rourke, and for today's show I've been sponsored by beardbase.co.uk. So if you're sick of your beard looking like a homeless chick's unkempt vagina, why not visit beardbase.co.uk today? beardbase.co.uk.
And I'm Carl Jones. There are many unanswered questions in the world, but over the past week I've managed to get the answers to the following three. What would Bill Watts look like with the hood on? Who was really responsible for graffito tagging the Nation of Domination's locker room? And who was responsible for the cancellation of Different Strokes?
Hulk Hogan, brother!
This is the panel for the 48th Squared Circle Gazette Radio, and you can hear us talk about the second quarter of 1997 in the Monday Night War. Next! Welcome to the 48th Squared Circle Gazette Radio. I am Liam O'Rourke, alongside G. John Chase.
Brother.
Kieran O'Rourke.
All right, treacle.
And Carl Jones.
The world don't move to the beat of just one drum.
Absolutely not, Carl. And we are here today, back once again, for the latest installment of our History of the Monday Night War timeline, covering from April to the end of June this time. If you haven't heard any of our previous episodes covering the History of the Monday Night War timeline with the assistance of notes from the Wrestling Observer newsletters of the time, you can go back and listen to them in the archives at squaredcirclegazette.com, where we keep all of our old shows. But we have a very interesting show here today, because usually we have a bigger break between timeline shows, but this quarter has so many fascinating notes to get to. We have so many of them, thanks to, as you mentioned, Dave Meltzer. So we'll get to them here. So much to talk about. So here we go. The first week of April, the buy rates for March came in this week, and there was much celebration in the WCW offices that Uncensored beat WrestleMania in the buy rates. 0.9 for Uncensored to 0.77 for WrestleMania. This stems largely what we spoke about in the first quarter of the year, but in terms of putting into perspective where both companies are at this period of time, I think this is a useful illustration of how things are going.
Well, yeah, it's just all the momentum of WCW. I'm not sure how many weeks they've won the ratings for at this point in a row, but it's momentum all on their side. And WWF scratching around looking for something to stick, really.
And I think just obviously the fact of, you know, Shawn Michaels, you know, screwing the pooch and fucking things up and them having to obviously change things on the buy a month beforehand and
No,
so
no,
on.
No, we established last week.
Is this good?
We established last month, sorry, when we did the last show.
Theme tune.
That, yeah, Shawn was perfectly entitled to pull a Shawn. With when it came down, they were going to put the belt back on Sid.
Yeah, Thursday Raw Thursday. Yeah.
Fuck that noise.
Yeah, and this ties into our next note here. Shawn Michaels is now hopeful to be back in the ring in May. So that's the current plan at the start of April here. Shawn Michaels is still on his hiatus. The first show of this quarter to get to is April 6th, WCW Spring Stampede. 8,356 fans sell out the building, a 0.58 buy rate for 159,000 buys. A decent show, says Dave Meltzer, but there's some interesting notes here. Scott Hall has been gone now for a few weeks dealing with personal problems, which was rehab. However, WCW never addressed to the fans who were buying this pay-per-view the fact that the company knew weeks in advance that Hall wasn't going to be doing the show, yet WCW continued to advertise Hall as appearing. Kevin Nash defends the tag belts against Rick Steiner in a singles match after a very lame angle where Scott Steiner is arrested backstage, for those who remember that. There's some NWO dissension teased throughout this show. DiBiase walks out on Nash during the match with Rick Steiner, and in the main event, the keynote here, Diamond Dallas Page pins Randy Savage with a diamond cut in the middle of the ring when Nick Patrick counts Savage out, and they do a post-match where Kevin Nash jackknifes him and Savage is going for Bischoff. DDP going over here, NWO dissension teased, any kind of these things you think play into the bigger picture of the Monday Night War at this point?
Well, it's debatable as to exactly how strong a role DDP did play in you know, the Monday Night Wars and Nitro in particular in terms of its success rate. You can't deny that this was what, for him personally, was the beginning of DDP's successful run and his lead up to being champion eventually.
Yeah, I just think what's probably notable about this, Savage and Page, is it still sticks out as one of the established guard putting over an unestablished guy. And the fact that it still sticks out like that because it happens so rarely.
Yeah, it's like the one of a handful of times, if that, that you can really point to.
In terms of truly an established guy putting a young guy over, I say young guy,
fresh versus stale sort of thing.
I mean, that's, you know, I mean, in terms of legitimately putting a guy over, it's probably, you know, one of two or three. I can't think of any off the top of my head, actually.
It's something that's probably not too prevalent now in the timeline, but it's certainly going to be a case of chickens coming home to roost as we get further down the line.
Absolutely. Moving to the next night here, April the 7th on Nitro. Hogan, Nash, Bischoff and Savage mend their fences in the ring. So the ended up being a one-day storyline. Actually, they had been teasing it in the weeks previously of Nash being disenfranchised.
When did last time?
No. For what is supposed to be a group of heels, the entire segment came off like everyone was trying to play cool babyface, says Dave Meltzer. So it's begun already. Flair came out with Piper and Kevin Green. They challenged Hogan, Hall and Nash for the Slamboree pay-per-view in Charlotte. The original plan was for the NWO to come out and accept the challenge, but the feeling is that Hogan doesn't want to do the match, so it'll be Hall, Nash and Six in the match instead. Just an interesting note there. In terms of the NWO angle coming to it, they do the tease where Nash and Hogan tease that they're going to fight in the ring, and then it all ends up being NWO for life and all much of a muchness. Reigns for the sake of ratings?
Yeah. Possibly, yeah. Just something to try and shake things up a little bit, perhaps. I don't. There's no sort of overarching theme to it at this point, I don't think.
Yeah, it's kind of, in many respects, it's similar to what we see today in WWE. It's like kind of that self-contained false drama from one show to the next. Say it's a ratings thing. I think it's more just that filler for the week story kind of thing.
Yeah.
In individual isolated instances, it probably doesn't do too much damage, but it's the cumulative effect, which is, you know, a common theme we're going to see of WCW as well. These repeated faux pas that I think over time it takes its toll.
With the exception of the fact that by now they've got a rough idea in their heads of where they're going by the end of the year.
Yeah.
On a week-by-week basis, they have no fucking idea. So they're just throwing shit at the wall, and they're just thinking, what can we do this week? And they're not considering what that's going to involve next week. It's just like, what do we do this week? We'll do it. Then when next week comes around, he goes, right, what the fuck did we do last week? And oh no, I don't like that idea now. I've had a shit and I've changed my mind. And also to say with the beginning of the note you just put there, was Meltzer that you were saying talking about it? It's, I was just thinking about like Kevin Nash and actually trying to think, did it ever, in Kevin Nash's career, did he ever play a heel and not a cool heel or cool babyface? Did he ever just play a heel? Well, he wasn't trying to be liked.
Maybe when he was just the muscle for Sean.
Yeah, so that's all I was coming up with as well.
I think he was still trying to be like cool dude then as well.
The one thing I would say though, in sort of the defence of WCW, if you like, at this point in time, is there's no real warning for them to heed. We can talk about sort of self-contained episodes and this sense of them just spitballing from one week to the next, because their ultimate goal is obviously to get to Hogan, Sting further down the line, and they're just sort of trying to keep things ticking over till then. But the ratings being what they are, you contrast the WrestleMania buy rate with Uncensored, which, whilst the Sting ending was fantastic, and we all talked about it before, Uncensored, a traditionally bad show, beating out WrestleMania, which, regardless of the card itself, still has a name recognition and a brand recognition at the time. When those things are happening for WCW, there's no warnings for them to necessarily heed. So whilst we can all sit here now and say, this was wrong, you know, when you're a prisoner of the moment, you know, it's a different kettle of fish.
You can turn around and state that they were like, you know, the little kid that's just been given the keys to the sweet shop. The kid's just going around and he's trying every single sweet possible, yet the adult who's probably watching in the background knows that they're going to throw up at some point during this consumption of sweets, you know. So it's just like, it's going to happen, but the kid's not going to pay any attention. He's not ignoring any advice. Yeah. He's going to throw up, but he doesn't care. He's still going to shove it down like Augustus Gloop.
Because it tastes good right now.
Yeah.
Also on this April 7th Nitro, Ultimo Dragon wins the television championship off Prince Iaukea. So that's...
Yes! Let's get rid of that travesty of justice. Prince Iaukea.
That's the end of that experiment. The finale is Diamond Dallas Page doing an interview. The NWO comes out. Hogan says he's going to take care of Page himself, at which point Sting comes down from the ceiling and throws Page a baseball bat as the show goes off the air. Over on Raw on April 7th, the main note here is Shawn Michaels' 15-minute shoot interview. It was easily the best segment on either show, although it got murdered in the ratings, says Dave Meltzer. This promo has to be discussed, because this is just part of the unravelling of Shawn Michaels, is the fascinating part of doing this timeline and revisiting some of these moments. Dave says there that he felt this was the best segment on either show, but if you listen to the audience, they're kind of coming and going with this promo. He's talking about a lot of stuff that a lot of people don't understand.
Oh, it's all backstage stuff, is it?
It's not necessarily all backstage stuff. It's just like, it's these jabs at Brett about how, you know, when Sean leaves the building, he's just plain old Sean, but Brett lives this 24 hours a day and he brings his family in because he'd sell his mother to make a buck.
Was this the one when he said, when I became IC champ, you were the world champ, and I came up to Calgary and said, you know, I'm happy with my place. Like, what's this supposed to mean? And there's others. I think, you know, this is obviously a company direction, because I'm not sure if it's this show or maybe the week after, with a Mankind one, which is kind of a similar vein, which I'm going to discuss with Carl, given Carl's angst with Bray Wyatt. Two things. One is obviously a company direction they're pushing, and I really do believe it's a Vince McMahon push promo, because he also does.
The question to Vince.
I just call it Sean Cena, because, you know, you can love me or you can boom, you can cheer me or you can boo me, but, you know, you're gonna get your money's worth. Whereas Brett's just here for the cash and blah blah. It's like Sean trying to be too cool for school, even though he looks really uncomfortable doing it.
He looks so frustrated. He's trying to play the cool guy, he seems so frustrated doing it. And although there's a very cryptic line at the end where he says, "Brett, read my lips. Your obsession with this company and your obsession with being the champion will be your destruction."
Yeah.
It's like, that's foreshadowing if there ever was any. Sid supposedly has a herniated disc in his back caused by working out in the gym. The reason it was handled so clumsily on Raw is because they didn't know about it as the show was going on and didn't know if he'd be there or not. Apparently Sid left a message at the office over the weekend, and since nobody was there, nobody knew, and he didn't think to call the building to let anybody know that he was hurt. Sid was supposed to lose to Mankind on this episode of Raw to set him up for The Undertaker at the next pay-per-view, and Sid was definitely supposed to put Bret Hart over at the next pay-per-view, since Bret had put him over 3 times in a row, and it was time for Bret to get the push. You can figure out the backstage skepticism from there. This is the first of many notes about young Sid.
Shit-stained Sid.
Ugh.
So was it a legit back injury?
We'll come to that.
Okay.
Do you think when he left that voice message that he cuts it the same way he does his promos?
Whispers and then screams.
And then whispers and screams. I have a bad back. I cannot make it.
Yeah.
But I'll be there next week.
Yeah, but at least, you know, with a recorded message, unlike his live promos, he can go again.
Nitro does a 3.7 this week to Raw's 2.2, so that's where the reigns are sitting at the moment. Reggie White of the Super Bowl champion Green Bay Packers signed to appear on the WCW Slamboree pay-per-view to face Steve McMichael in the semi-main event this week. There is absolutely no talk about doing that live Thursday night show on TBS, nor are any arenas booked for live Thursday tapings at the moment. TBS offered big money for the show, but apparently common sense may win out after all, since it will destroy the personal lives of most of the office and a lot of the wrestlers, not to mention possibly dilute the winning Monday night formula. So this obviously is what would become Thunder, as we mentioned this in the previous quarter, but common sense may win out after all is the line there, and
nah.
Money talks.
Yeah. April 11th, Vader appears on Good Morning Q8 and is asked by the is asked by the host if wrestling was fake. Vader grabbed the host by the tie and said the question was bullshit, and shoved him backwards in his chair and knocked over a flower pot. Police were called immediately, and White was arrested both for assault and for lascivious conduct, because it is illegal in Q8 to swear on television. Vader was placed under house arrest and detained in Q8 as a result. So that's quite a funny note here, because this would actually get quite a bit of publicity for Vader. Poor Leon, you know. It's actually funny when you watch this back, because you can find this video on YouTube. He looks so much like Eric Cartman.
This did lead to the Vader hostage in Q8 vignettes.
Yeah, the Iran hostage crisis, this is not.
Like, the best thing is probably Lawler's Vader doll that he's painted.
He's drawn the bars on!
He's drawn bars on the plastic box. Fantastic. Yeah. Lawler through his period is just, I love this guy.
Lawler's on fire during this whole year. He's great watching some of this stuff back. He's ridiculous. Moving to April 14th on Nitro, it's the second largest crowd in the history of the WCW promotion, selling out 16,256 seats, and it devastated the all-time merchandise record at $143,000. Flair, Piper, and Green did an interview. What they said stems from a meeting where Nash, Bischoff, Flair, and Piper met about problems with the Slamboree main event last week. Since Hogan doesn't want to do the pay-per-view, as we mentioned, Flair and Piper don't want Six in the main event, feeling that like with a star like Kevin Green involved, Six wasn't a big enough name from a main event credibility standpoint to be in such a position. Nash argued that given the talent in the match, Six would be the only one who could make the match good, and insulted the current aging condition of Flair and Piper and called Flair a comedy act to his face. There was still considerable heat from the Uncensored pay-per-view where Nash cut Piper off and wouldn't sell for him. Anyway, these three guys did an interview for exactly one person, Kevin Nash, who was probably laughing his way through all this because they all exposed a lot of insecurity. It was only supposed to go 3 minutes but wound up going 9 because they couldn't stop making no sense. This promo is so weird because when you actually watch this back, where you got Piper talking about paving the way and potholes and all this stuff, and you know, we laid the asphalt down, and it's like you can watch this, and again, it's like you kind of get the vague idea of what they're trying to get at here of, you know, legends versus upstarts kind of a thing, but it's all so vague and cloudy that it's just it's one hand clapping. We saw this last week with Shawn Michaels. It's a more pronounced case this week, I find, with Flair and Piper.
Yeah, it's this and I hate to use the term, but it's this element of the worked shoot.
Oh yeah,
if you like. And as you say, it's prevalent in Sean's case, but at least I'd almost give Sean a pass in the sense of he's having a breakdown at this point. So, you know, he doesn't know at what point he's shooting or working. Well, with the drugs, he might know when he's shooting, but oh, that's a different story.
Cheap shot call.
It's starting to become a bit more prevalent. I'm sure we'll see that with the retort that follows.
Also on this show, Stephen Michael and Reg White do a pull apart brawl to set up Slamboree.
Oh God, I watched this yesterday. It's awful. It's absolutely terrible.
The match or the pull apart? The match we'll get to.
The match is awful, but the pull apart stinks. The only thing I can say about it is that obviously Mongo didn't do his rails that night.
April 14th of all, this is from South Africa. This is the kind of weird split show from South Africa and America.
To say, yeah, I text this to you. The flag that they used for the logo was the apartheid flag, which I think ceased to be used in 94.
Yeah.
But at the shows, Brett had like the new South African and the current South African flag, so I don't know what that was all about. Hogan was in charge of production, maybe.
Oh, come on. In the words of Dave Meltzer, the show sucked. Ahmed Johnson versus Crush main event was like a worst match of the year candidate. Horrific match with blown spots galore. The sound mixing on the show was terrible as well.
Brett in the toilet cutting promos.
That's awesome. Jim Ross and his hotline acknowledged that this was a poor show. So, and if I'm not mistaken, Carl, we were talking about this yesterday, but there were some backstage ramifications for this show.
It's been reported by a few people, and there may be somebody out there listening who's got more knowledge on this than me, but if I'm not mistaken, it's this Raw show that leads to old Vinnie Roo being brought onto creative.
It was a split show between America and South Africa.
They pretended it was a simulcast.
Yeah, and they tried to cut back and forth with the commentators communicating.
The honky-tonk man on commentary.
he's kind of like King today.
Yeah.
The one thing I would say about this show, and we talked about it in the previous edition of this timeline, WWF trying to go for the sort of the bigger spectacle, and you know, we talked about it with the Raw show in the Sky Dome, for example, and it's one of those things where the theory, you know, the sort of the logic behind it is absolutely fine. You know, this sense of big show at the Sky Dome, make it look like we've got the real hot product, a massive crowd, show in South Africa with a global company, all these things you try to project, but the execution, again, as you referenced there, Liam, is absolutely terrible.
Yeah,
I see there's a lot of hallmarks between that Canada show and the South Africa show in the way that, you know, just the appearance of everything, it's poorly lit like the Canada show was. Yeah. The audio's not very good, you know, nothing about it comes off as top notch, and when you contrast that with, as we referenced before, the production values over on the other side, it's just sort of salt in the wounds.
Yeah,
and I'm not sure if the guys took it as like a house show, but the in-ring work was fucking atrocious.
They didn't try at all
throughout the show.
Yeah.
You wouldn't know if Crush and Ahmed Johnson were trying or not.
That's why I said throughout the show.
In terms of good ideas and execution, you can follow this into the WrestleMania 2 folder, I feel. Nitro gets a 3.5 to Raw's 2.2 this week, so nothing changes too much there. We move to that Sunday, April 20th, In Your House, Taker's Revenge. 6,477 fans in the building, a 0.5 buy rate for 138,000 buys, so not a great number. Bret and Austin in the main event ends in a very cheap disqualification. The Undertaker fireballs Paul Bearer on this show, which will end up being a recurring storyline, and Rockabilly debuts. I don't know if anybody wants to comment on the implications historically of Rockabilly. Moving swiftly along to the next night. April 21st, Vader is arrested again in Kuwait on a charge of disorderly conduct and public drunkenness that resulted in 20 police officers, people from the US embassy, and his lawyer having to come to the hotel to calm him down. So, big Leon not dealing with it too well there. That same night on August 21st, we move to Monday Nitro. Nick Patrick did an interview wearing a WCW shirt asking to be reinstated, so the merry-go-round has begun. Yep. They did an interview with J.J. Dillon, who is now the lead babyface suit of WCW to feud with Eric Bischoff. The story is that Bischoff is under contract to WCW and can't be fired, but he has no power. Somehow they announced that Big Bubba and Michael Wall Street must return to WCW. Don't expect logic in any of this, says Dave Meltzer. Also on the show, the NWO did an interview, as you mentioned, Carl Nash makes his own comeback here, saying Roddy Piper is one brain cell away from being in a coma, and complained that Piper and Flair took everything from the business, gave nothing back, and left it a mess for guys of his generation to put back together. He said WCW would only push the sons of wrestlers when he got started. This is a very, we'd seen the traces of this in the previous quarter of Sullivan doing these weird promos, trying to delve into reality and stuff like that. And of course, Nash is talking about how when Scott Hall was there before, he was ready to be a star, but he was a little bit green himself. And it's like, it's all a very strange way to build a pay-per-view.
Well, it's bullshit for a start. The Diamond Stud was not ready to become a star. It doesn't bother me as much here because there is still the confines of that storyline for Slambury, and it is still within the remit of sort of building towards that pay-per-view. Some of the lines, I don't like about pushing the sons and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, what does that mean to a casual fan?
Yeah, it means nothing. But at least you can grasp, as you say, the straws of the old guard against the new guys, legends versus upstart sort of thing. There's still enough there for your casual fan to take that bit in. I don't have too much of a problem with it at that point.
But the only thing I'd just say, just kind of musing more than anything else, is it's this element of unscripted and very much away from the tradition of pro wrestling, and we're seeing, we're talking about the growing and the sustained growth of WCW at this point. Is there an argument to be made that it was another element in that kind of realism that they tried to bring in away from traditional wrestling?
I'm not sure I want to give Bischoff that much credit with regards to your earlier point, Kieran, but I can certainly see it does tie into the philosophy, if you like. But again, I'd stress, I don't think it's too inside at this point. Case of Shawn and Bret, they have wrestled before. These comments do often gravitate back towards the belt and being the top guy in the promotion, which a casual fan can still get behind. Things such as sunny days, remarks like that, are absolutely over everyone's head. It's like the Sid and Scissors remark, all that sort of thing. Yeah, that's complete BS. But when there's still strands of it that a fan can relate to, which I think there are at this point, again, I'm not that upset about it.
Moving over to Raw on April 21st, one of the best Raws in history. Steve Austin injures Bret Hart in a street fight. And again, attacks Bret Hart in the ambulance afterwards. Fantastic stuff. For the rest of the show, you got Davey and Owen after Steve Austin, Sean after Davey and Owen. Brian Pillman returns at the end of the show to attack Steve Austin. Just a great great show, ebb and flow. You get your Tiger Rally Sings and versus Sal Sincere matches in there too, but nothing's perfect. The angle itself was actually a last-minute decision, based on perhaps the worst possible thing that could happen right now to the WWF, a right knee injury to Bret Hart that requires surgery. So this whole show, which is a fantastic show, is brought about by accident, but just talk about this Raw a little bit, because Steve Austin is just absolutely fantastic here. Bret's great too, and Bulldog is a silent star here. Maybe not so silent with some of his comments, but it's his knee.
Owen and Davey, we've said it a number of times, they were going to be limited by their promo ability, but goddamn, as wacky heels, they're funny. And as Bret's lackeys, they're just kind of perfect.
They are Bret's Patterson and Briscoe.
What's so great about the Harper Nation. It's all about Bret, and it's really like Bret just being the don of the group. And it's the Austin rise kind of fortuitous in one respect, when you've got Bret and Shawn with their shenanigans and injuries. It's okay, well, what can we do? Oh no, let's have six segments this week with Steve Austin, because he's fucking great in all of them.
Yeah.
And he's just, it's fortuitous, but he's just so goddamn great every single time.
Yeah, that's kind of the sweet irony, isn't it, really? Where, as you said, Shawn and Bret are fighting over this turf, this small bit of turf in this main event, this championship belt that they want. And in the meantime, they haven't got any of their eyes on the one guy who's actually building up momentum. And guess what? He's going to be champion within a year.
And a bigger star than either of you.
The biggest star ever. You know, so they're not keeping an eye on him.
I think, by this point, do they know they want to push Steve right to the top? Because it really feels like that when he's on so many segments.
It does.
Maybe it's just because, you know, I said with Sid out, yes, Sean pulling a Sean, Brett with his injury. You know, there's space there. They need a guy to tie the shows together. So maybe it's just fortuitous and it ends up, you know, he gets over so much. But it certainly feels like that, you know, in the long term,
they've made their mind up.
They know. Yeah, I think I really got that feeling.
The hot show led to the WWF tightening the gap in the ratings as Nitro did a 3.4 to Raw's 2.75. So they pulled that deficit a little bit closer. The WWF got a rare quarter hour win with a 3.4 for the Austin Brett Street fight. So it did pay off. A very good show here. Interesting note here for the next little while. Because of the NBA playoffs, Nitro is being moved starting next week to a 1-hour format starting at 7 p.m, which means Raw will be going unopposed until mid-May. A few weeks here where Raw's going to be able to try and capture some of that lost ground over the last little while. Bruce Pritchard and Jim Ross met with the wrestlers from Michinoku Pro that appeared on the ECW Bayley Legal pay-per-view, which happened the week prior, about working in the WWF. Reports are that the chances of doing business together appear good at this point, and the WWF is planning on starting a lighter weight division shortly. This is one of those things I want to mention just briefly here about how when they started to do this, there were many instances of this in terms of, you know, mirroring what Nitro was doing, Raw intros at the second hour and the pyro at the start of the second hour, the new announcer, that were things directly taken from Nitro. When they did this, this felt to me very much of, let's poach what WCW's doing.
In terms of that light heavyweight division, it's hard to kind of badmouth a division that has, you know, Takuma Shinoku and Dick Togo, because Dick Togo's fucking awesome.
The great Dick Togo.
The great Dick Togo's just fucking awesome, but that light heavyweight division was...
You can diss it, because it's terrible.
It was such a poor substitute for what WCW had. I mean, it was pretty much just Japanese wrestlers and Brian Lawler, wasn't it? That's pretty much it.
Scott Taylor as well.
Scott Taylor.
And I'd like to bring back to the Paul Heyman court case, where I made the point that at this point in time, in this period...
We lost
both
it, dude.
Company. No! Both companies would sign talent from all over the shop. So that was just my argument against Paul Heyman being, you know, vital for bringing certain guys into the major leagues.
WCW has also made major plays for several ECW wrestlers since Bayley Legal and offered Raven a 3-year deal at $225,000 a year to join the New World Order. Which he's accepted. WCW wants him to start in June, but ECW has him under contract until August, which will become a story in the next episode of the timeline. April 24th, Vader returns to America. You'll all be glad to know. Just in time for April 28th of Nitro, which opened with clips of Ric Flair beating and pinning Vader at Starrcade 93, in light of all the publicity Vader had got.
It's just refreshing to see Flair getting a bit of shine on his own show.
Yeah, getting beating somebody else up. Yeah. Flair and Piper come out to fight the NWO, and Flair uttered the line of the night, saying that he'd been the world champion more times than Six had pieces of ass in his entire life. Yeah. There was a lot of talk about suspending Flair or not letting him do live interviews after that one. Which isn't the first or the last time that Flair would get threatened with not doing interviews.
Well, that's fucking a laugh, isn't it? They want to be fucking real and gritty and make little sly little comments, and then, like, you know, Ric Flair comes out with a fucking doozy. That's one thing you don't do with Ric Flair until now. You do it now. Yeah, you censor him now, but not then.
You can't make the heels look uncool, though.
Of course not. Yeah,
not with a big old, big sexy around.
Big Kev, yeah. It is quite funny though, because after Flair says it, the announcers go quiet for a second, and Zbysko just goes, "Don't look at me." Flair goes to fight the NWO when they come out, gets outnumbered, and screams for Piper. Piper's just kind of standing there in the ring and delays until he finally joins in to end the show. So a little bit of a tease of kind of differing intentions between Piper and Flair here, which we'll play in later. Over on Raw on April 28th, this is the Brian Pillman prayer promo to start the show, which is great. I love this promo so much, where he swears allegiance to his Lord and Messiah, Bret Hart, pretty much, and begs God to strike down Steve Austin, which is just hilarious stuff. Also on the show, Owen Hart pins Rocky Maivia to win the Intercontinental Championship, which you mentioned before, Kieran.
When Owen wins the IC title, he like gives it to Bret. It's just fantastic.
The original plan here was for Bret Hart to win the Intercontinental Championship from Rocky Maivia at King of the Ring, change in plan with Bret's injury. Vader, in his return to the United States on Raw, bullies Jim Ross until Ken Shamrock gives him a belly-to-belly suplex to set up their match at Cold Day in Hell, which is coming up in a month's time. And at the end of Raw, Jim Neidhart returns and joins the Hart Foundation, which is really what the world was calling for.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know, the times talk about Shamrock maybe the first time. A guy who's surely his gimmick was built in, this guy's gonna be a badass.
Yeah.
The anti-bullying gimmick, it made him just look such a pussy in my eyes.
How about the challenging Mike Tyson to a fight the week before this?
Oh yeah. Yeah, the most believable, realistic. I mean, I just look at the face. You've got Shamrock, who's the anti-bullying pussy. You've got whiny Shawn Michaels, bitchy Bret Hart. And it's no wonder Steve Austin became the hottest thing on the show, for fuck's sake.
Ken Shamrock, due to obviously what his background was in UFC and so on, was really kind of purpose-built to have surely a pretty substantial role, at least maybe in the main event scene. You know, something being a bit different, a bit kind of real. But they just, for me, they never seem to really capitalize on it.
Well, I think that's what they're trying with the challenge to Tyson. And I think with regards to Vader, I think it's another one of those where they've got this sort of this picture in mind. And I don't necessarily think it's so much Ken Shamrock is against bullying sort of thing.
Later
on, maybe it is. But the impression I always got initially was it's this sense of, you know, we've got this legit tough guy. And we've got Vader, who has a reputation as a,
he's just coming off,
Vader, who just spent a few nights in the big house, coming out, and you can see this sort of sense of this. It's that attempt to be sort of gritty and real, but Vince can't quite commit because it's just not naturally in his nature, which is why you get Ken Shamrock is against bullying further down the line. Problem is, the guy can't talk. He can't cut a promo.
He could in the UFC.
He could in the UFC, but in the parameters of the World Wrestling Federation.
Maybe he's just kind of falling into himself still a little bit. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree that, you know, this little mini feud with Vader isn't the time when he's being anti-bullying. But by the end of this three-month period, he absolutely is. Yeah. It's, for me, the comparison is Goldberg, because Goldberg being on an anti-bullying kick, that would have worked. But Goldberg didn't exactly cut, you know, to 10-minute monologues. So I just think it was kind of another example of Vince miscasting a guy in his vision for a babyface superstar.
Raw did a 3.4 this week, unopposed, with no Nitro. Nitro is a one-hour show in a new time slot. They only did a 2.7. So Raw, obviously, it's not really a fair comparison there because it's Raw in its regular time slot, but does very well unopposed. WCW merchandise continues to do phenomenal business. The Sting t-shirt is now the top seller everywhere, followed by the NWO and the new DDP t-shirt. So there you go. NWO no longer the top seller, as we mentioned in the last podcast.
No, and it goes to show that there has been some payoff to Savage putting over DDP, certainly gaining traction.
Absolutely.
Unless he bought like a bunch of a shitload himself.
Yeah, and handed them out to his friends.
I wouldn't put that past him.
It's possible. The current plan at this point is Shawn Michaels versus Bret Hart and Undertaker versus Ahmed Johnson for King of the Ring. Ugh. Keep that in mind, folks. The May 5th Nitro. It opened up with a Flair, Kevin Green, Roddy Piper promo, which went nowhere. In the middle, they began playing Public Enemy's music because it was a one-hour show, and they weren't ending it on time. So they just played the nah, and that's the end of it. They cut away to the crowd. The NWO attacked the Giant and DDP and Harlem Heat in the main event. Roddy Piper, Ric Flair, and Kevin Green do a run-in and get beat up too. So they say, the theme of the show is heat on the NWO. Major storyline snafu of the week was Wall Street coming out as a member of the NWO after JJ Selly couldn't be. Round and round we go.
No one would have noticed that.
No one noticed. Over on Raw May 5th, Bret Hart and the Hart Foundation open up the show with a promo in the ring, the fully formed Hart Foundation. They aired a Goldust video sans makeup this week, showing him and Marlena as Dustin and Terry Runnels, showing the baby pictures of him with Dusty. The explanation was that he took the Goldust gimmick to get away from his father's shadow.
I think it was good in the context of Goldust. I think
he needed something.
He'd floundered, yeah, exactly, and it was really neat for him, and I think he came across well. He came across sympathetic, had that real element to it. So I was a fan. I liked it.
I will say here, in the Observer, it says, in the arena when the video was airing, people were laughing about it, which I don't think was the desired reaction. So there's a bit of a split opinion there on that one. I actually quite liked it too. I thought it showed Dustin in quite a favourable light. The main theme of the show is Undertaker gets his belt stolen. Turns out that Bret stole it, but it winds up in Austin's hands, and Taker attacks Austin to kind of a heat up cold day in hell, which is this Sunday a little bit more. Raw again does a 3.4 unopposed, so it maintains the audience from the prior week. Nitro does a 2.6 in its different time slot.
Just want to mention quickly, this, although Austin's going for the belt, it's so secondary. Even his own attention is on the Hart Foundation still.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is a common theme for these 3 months with Undertaker and his world title challenges. very secondary and
very much taken aback.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sid's MRI, as you mentioned before, whether or not this was a legitimate injury, Kieran, revealed a lower lumbar strain, not the herniated disc that he claimed. It's an injury that anyone who's ever lifted weights has had, and it's probably not advisable to wrestle with it, but I'll bet tons of wrestlers have worked with a lot more serious injuries. During the week, the plan was again for him to show up at TV and wrestle Mankind at the next pay-per-view, but once again that didn't happen. He's off the pay-per-view and his future with the company is very much in doubt. This fucking guy. We move to May 11th, WWF Cold Day in Hell. 9,381 fans in the building, a 0.58 buy rate for 159,000 buys, so not a noticeable, appreciable jump for Steve Austin there, challenging for the world title here. Ken Shamrock's first match is on this show, however, against Vader. What was everyone's thoughts about Shamrock's first match against Big Leon? Actually, quite, I thought this was a really good showing for Shamrock.
Yeah, doesn't he, if I'm not mistaken, doesn't he break Vader's nose?
Yeah, John Cena's him. He knees him in the nose and breaks his nose in four places. Vader's legs were shot from all the leg kicks to the point he couldn't even walk until the following Friday, and he needed fluid drained from his knee as well. So he really came out of this one the worst for wear.
It's been a bad month for Leon.
It's been a rough month. There are people who have faced Shamrock in shoot fights that haven't ended up that bad, you know?
No, not honestly, it's been a rough couple of years for Leon, truth be told. Yeah. But and just pray tell, how did the WWF capitalise on those circumstances?
They did mention it in passing on Raw.
Yeah, well, that's good. That's it. Austin's whole thing of running for the belt is completely secondary. He loses the match to Taker, but the whole story is the heart's at ringside. Austin stuns Taker at the end and gets his music playing while the show goes off the air, so the focus is still very much Steve Austin.
Yeah, and they put over that he came close to winning, and seeing as though it didn't do a big buy rate, you know, it didn't do too much harm. Just one thing, although Austin's attention wasn't solely on going for the title, because he wasn't winning, I'm not too against that, really. But I think one of the things that really grinds my gears, doesn't grind my gears, I think it hurts guys today, is when so much focus is put on, I'm going to do this, and then it's the 50-50 pulled from underneath their legs. Anything they say going forward is completely, so what? We know it's bullshit.
So. Yeah. The babyface promising something and then failing to deliver.
Yeah, and it's, just to sort of echo your points, in the sense of the build for this show, like we say, it wasn't really about the title, was it? They would mention that Austin was going for the belt against Undertaker, but it was never the focal point of the sell of the pay-per-view, really. It was always, you know, what role are the Hearts going to play, because we know they're going to be there.
The ever-changing Monday Night Wrestling Wars will begin yet another chapter in August, with the USA Network moving the time slot of Raw, mostly to a 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. time slot beginning in August. In theory, it would enable the show to get more risque with a later time slot, which is obviously, as we know, the direction that they would go down. Eric Bischoff, at a meeting with the wrestlers that same day, did hint at the idea of Nitro going to 3 hours in response. If it did, the possibility would be that the third hour would be on TBS instead of TNT. That way, TBS gets the live weekly primetime wrestling show to boost their ratings, and the added costs of running another live taping every week would be avoided. So there's the original idea for 3-hour Nitros and the unfortunate litany of 3-hour television that we see to this sad day.
3 hours on a Monday, 2 hours on a Thursday.
And that's what they ended up going with instead. Yeah. Also in the same meeting, it was announced that Kevin Sullivan was taking a hiatus as booker for 4 to 8 weeks due to burnout and outside personal pressures as well. And obviously at this point, and it would be revealed later on, that it's the split of Kevin and Nancy that is in large part for this absence, but the angle with Chris and Nancy, and this is how it turned out. May 12th Nitro, a flat show. Bischoff said he's going to interview Sting, but instead he interviewed the imposter Sting. The real Sting comes out and drops the imposter with a scorpion death drop while Bischoff runs away through the crowd, so nothing really notable on this Nitro. Over on Raw, at the end of the show, Bret Hart asks Shawn Michaels to come out, and he begins insulting him to his face, but went on way too long, and the show went off the air before the climax of the angle, which was Shawn Michaels superkicking Bret out of his wheelchair.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. If you want to know why shows today are so heavily scripted, this is, for me, is an example of why.
Yeah.
Guys, you know, run into a strict time scale. Yeah, this promo is just, it's surreal. I mean, he talks about, you know, story of your career is getting hot then cold,
yeah.
And more, Sean's just kind of standing there. Look, Brett's in his wheelchair as well.
Yeah, wheelchair Brett is such a fucking asshole.
He's great. He's such a great douchebag.
And it's just like the bit that actually, I guess, doesn't get shown is just he gets up out of the chair. And he's just really like going for it with.
You don't have the insides to hit me.
Yeah, you don't even have the insides to hit me. And it's just like, yeah, boom, just smacks him
perfect sweet chin. But yeah, I don't know whether it was actually official at the time, whether we just said it afterwards, but what was Sean's mood like once he found out that they'd gone over and so his super kick did not air?
He was fucking furious, and it was made worse by the fact that it comes out in later observes that Triple H got in his ear and convinced him that Brett did it on purpose and backstabbed him on live television, which we'll come to that 1 week later, what happens as a result. Also on this May 12th Raw, however, Rob Van Dam debuts as Mr. Monday Night and beats Jeff Hardy. This is the start of the Mr. Monday Night angle, coming off Bayley Legal.
I liked it. It was fresh on the show. Lawler was his mouthpiece. I think he actually caught a promo, and his promo was fine as well.
Yeah, he did.
Lawler was there, great, saying he was the only piece of talent in ECW. Yeah. It was good business.
Good stuff here. Paul Bearer also on the show with his face all wrapped up from the fireball. Did an interview saying he was going to reveal something The Undertaker doesn't want known unless Undertaker agrees to come back to him.
Oh. And it wasn't that Paul Bearer's ginger.
Farouk also didn't... Yeah, and then the reveal is that Taker is too. Yeah. Farouk also did an interview about The Undertaker to set up his world title match at King of the Ring, bringing up that there had never been a black WWF champion and said there had only ever been token Intercontinental champions. This is the start of this, for the rest of this course, a very heavy racial element of the Nation of Domination.
Yeah, I don't know how it's perceived like in American stuff. I liked it because it just felt real and edgy, and it was, yeah. I thought it was really good.
The stuff later on I actually like a lot, actually, yeah. From this thing.
Farouk's delivery was fantastic.
Yeah, it's great.
He was, yeah, good stuff.
It's very kind of walking the line, and really, while some people might kind of frown at it or might not like it, maybe turned off by it, but yeah, I mean, I liked how Farouk kind of worked with this. I thought there was definitely an opportunity for Farouk to be higher than what he ended up
being.
Well,
this is when they were going with him. This is the closest he got to that real top line push.
Yeah. Supposed to be Taker and Ahmed.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, you may have noticed the change here. It is now Farouk and Taker. We'll get to Ahmed Johnson. There's some more interesting notes on Ahmed later. But
yeah, I wasn't against this Black Power.
Yeah, the Black Power
kind of movement, and when Rock came into it as well. You know, I kind of liked it.
You say he kind of got elevated, but he really wasn't, because it was similar to Austin. He didn't actually the month before. He didn't win or earn his title shot.
He just got given it. And this it did lead to some great Brian Pillman commentary on Shotgun crying about how the race card was being played. It's fantastic stuff. Nitro at 7 p.m. did a 2.8 to Raw's unopposed 3.2 in its proper time slot. So the Raw main slipped a little bit while the Nitro one has gained, even in the different time slots, not head to head. Kevin Green was asked to turn heel on Ric Flair and Roddy Piper and join the NWO in Charlotte, where we played, but Kevin Green nixed that angle. So
I bet he did.
Yeah, I bet he did real fast.
Is any further evidence needed that they wanted the NWO to be baby faces, really?
Yeah.
Then turning green,
joining the in Charlotte.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. And notably being, you know, turning on Flair in Charlotte. Another chance to bury Flair in the Carolinas.
There's a pattern developing. May 18th, we get to WCW Slamboree. 9,643 fans sell out the building for a 0.6 buy rate. 165,000 buys for this show. Flair's first match in 8 months as he, Piper and Green beat the NWO clean. Piper attempted to pull out of the match and wanted to do a singles match with Six instead, who he personally likes as he'd soured on Hall and Nash, which led to the booking concession of Hall, Nash and Six agreeing to do a three-way job finish, which popped the crowd beyond belief. In return, Hall and Nash will theoretically get their win back at the Great American Bash in June to allow Flair and Piper then to go and do their own angle working as opponents.
I love it. They all lose, so really no one loses.
No one loses, yeah. Really. Plus they get the...
It's a third of a job each, really.
Yeah. Precisely. It also featured easily the worst match of this or any other year, the Steve McMichael versus Reggie White fiasco. So, Carl, you mentioned before about how bad the pull-apart was. Please enlighten us with your thoughts on the five-star classic that was Mongo White.
I almost feel a little bit like a trauma victim in the sense that my memories of it aren't crystal clear. I can't picture everything exactly. I just recall that it was painful and hurt, and I don't like to talk about it anymore.
If you remember Bigelow and LT, the way LT is clearly the guy being led through the match by Bigelow, like at times when he wouldn't know what to do, he was just kind of go and grab him. It's like both guys in the LT role. Yeah.
I thought you were going to say it was like Mongo trying to lead him through the match. It's like, that's fucking the blind.
That's even worse. The next night, May 19th on Nitro, Flair and Six do an angle to lead to the main event match, which lasted 1 minute before Hull and Nash ran in and kicked Ric Flair's ass. So there's all the momentum from the night before for Flair gone. The show ends with an Eric Bischoff interview running down Sting, saying they know that he was coming from the ceiling, and then Sting came from under the ring and gave Bischoff the Scorpion Death Drop. So they're continuing this very slow build of Sting hitting and running here on the NWO. Over on Raw, May 19th, we mentioned what happened last week at the end of the show with Shawn not getting his kick in. The show started with them hinting at a tag title match next week with Austin and Michaels challenging Owen and Davey. We have a pull-apart brawl with Austin and Shawn. Bob Holly in his hometown beats Owen Hart in a non-title match with an inside cradle when Owen Hart refused to beat Bob Holly clean in his hometown and insisted that he put Bob Holly over, which is...
Owen would never make it in the NWA, would he?
No, I was thinking,
just think of the contrast with what's happening down in Atlanta.
Exactly. Later in the show, the Hart Foundation all destroyed Bob Holly, with Brian Pillman noticeably using a squeegee as a weapon. Fantastic. First part of a Mankind interview series with Jim Ross airs. This is the knock-on of what we see with Dustin previously. They tried it with Dustin, they try it again here with Mick Foley. Mick Foley's far more in character, but not in character in these. These are the famous promos, everybody's seen these. This is the first part.
Foley's a different beast entirely when it comes to kind of details. I mean, his backstory is a lot more intricate than son of a plumber. Just the whole series I just thought was great. I mean, Jim Ross is obviously just great playing just the straight guy role. A notable dynamic shift in Foley's character. It's all on Foley to sell it, and it's just the thing of, it's, as I said, it's the background, it's the videos, all of it coming together. But the stuff that really works, the stuff that gets to the audience in the end and connects to them, is things like this. This guy is a down to earth guy. He's one of you guys. He tried to do wrestling when he was a kid and so on. Tried to be the big shot, and look at him. He's fought and he's clawed, and now he's in a company. Yeah. That's the stuff that connects with audiences.
The stars align, if you like, in the same way that the Brett and Shawn problems allow Austin the room to sort of grow. It gives other talent like Goldust, who needs a refresh, and Foley, just a chance to be showcased. And I think G summed it up quite well there with regards to the Foley one. I think the way it differs to Goldust is empathy. People can relate to the person who wasn't the most muscular, who isn't this 6'6", 6'7" megastar, you know, with muscles and all that sort of thing. So when people see that and it's someone they can root for, it almost creates sort of a bit of a feel good.
Well, it humanised the freak character. So.
Yeah. I was going to say I love this because what it did, it took these cartoon characters, first of all the Goldust one, and then even more successfully Mankind, it took the cartoon characters and gave a reason why they are these characters.
Why they are the way they are, yeah.
Slightly different in that with Dustin, he was saying I had to come up with something to be my own man, whereas with Mankind, it was still in character, and then it was a part of his split personality. Wasn't showing, he wasn't Mick Foley. They talked about Mick Foley, but Mankind was like a product of Mick Foley's upbringing. So it's slightly different, but it gave substance to these cartoon characters. When I mentioned earlier about the Mankind promo, I think it was maybe two, three, maybe 4 weeks before this, he cut a promo backstage as Mankind. It's before they'd done these humanizing angles with JR, but he referenced working main events for less money than other guys, and he mentioned how he has family and kids. And at that point, it was totally out of character for Mankind. It was out of context. They hadn't done these humanized angles. That promo coming before, albeit he was a heel when he did the initial one, and this series, by the end of the series, he was a babyface, and he was pushed as a babyface going forward afterwards. That initial promo came about a month before. I just wanted to know, as a huge Foley fan, Carl, and a guy who disses Bray Wyatt's promos for being nonsensical and confusing, how did that initial promo take you? Because for me, it was completely out of character. It was out of context for the direction of the character at the time, and it was confusing for me. So I just want to know your take on it.
Is this the promo before Revenge of Taker, where he references about sort of usually the cream of the crop that rise to the top, but every now and then it was quite strange. I don't necessarily think at the time I thought about it on that deeper level, but it did strike me as odd that a character who in some respects had talked more in riddles and talked about pain and suffering and all that sort of thing, it did strike me as odd that he's talking about main events, talking about winning a championship. That there were things that stuck out to me as slightly strange. I don't think I'd read it on that deeper level, though, to be honest.
In hindsight, obviously, it's it's more the family line for me. It's like he was sitting there and he's rocking back and forth and he talks about his family. It's like he's never mentioned a family.
This
before.
Guy's got a fucking wife and kids.
Yeah, exactly. It's just completely out of context. And I think what it was, they were obviously looking for this realism element, which they then find the niche with the vignettes with JR.
But at least is it worth giving the company credit, or maybe someone like a Jim Ross credit, perhaps, in the sense of they at least knew they had the right person in Foley to try this with. If you look back at his body of work and you see things like the Kane Dewey promo and that sort of thing, yeah, if it was going to work with anyone, it would be this person.
Speaking of more realistic promos here, Bret Hart did an interview saying that if he didn't beat Shawn Michaels in less than 10 minutes at King of the Ring, he'd never wrestle in the US again, and Michaels agreed. This is a Meltzer quote here. Judging from his delivery, there appeared to be something wrong with Michaels, and there was heat on him for making the comment about Bret seeing a lot of sunny days, since they weren't supposed to be making inside references that have nothing to do with storyline anymore.
The bastard was covering his own tracks.
What made that line even greater was the fact that I think on this show, Sonny was advertising the Super Soaker with the catchline, "Wetter is better."
Well, I guess you would know. But so Shawn Michaels, and probably not for the first time, showing up seemingly impaired during this. He's glassy-eyed and slurring his words a little bit here.
It's all starting to unravel, isn't it?
We've been down this path for about 6 months now, Sean.
Okay then.
This is a big, long start.
It's picking up momentum.
It is. The snowball is rolling. Paul Bearer got on the video wall and said that he was going to reveal the secret unless Undertaker agreed to let him manage him again, but Undertaker begged him not to and asked to give him another week to make up his mind. Lashley does a 3.1 against the unopposed Raw's 3.6. The shows go back head-to-head next week, so that's a key note here because obviously they've had this four-week period unopposed to try and build some momentum. The episodic stuff with Taker and Bearer, the teasers next week, you're going to see it. Michaels' first match back is happening next week on television, not at a pay-per-view. Team up with Austin against Davey and Owen.
No, it wasn't. They were both looking for other partners.
During the course of this show, they were looking for other partners until at the end it was made. The match was made.
Shawn got Shamrock because, you know, all good white boys together.
Oh, yes. Very interesting there.
And Austin was talking to Harvey Wimpleman.
Harvey Wimpleman then beats up the Brawler.
Because he just wants an excuse to basically not have a partner because he's Steve Austin, goddammit.
Yeah.
But I think there's a couple of telling things there. We talked earlier about the humanising of characters, particularly the cartoon characters of Goldust and Mankind, and it's telling this is the first real effort to do it with The Undertaker as well. Again, you're talking about the backstory that they're only teasing at the moment, they're not going into any detail, but you mentioned there you've got Undertaker begging Bearer not to reveal a family secret, and the sense of families again and all that sort of tie-in, it helps to see this, that they really have got this sort of this theme they're trying to develop and a pattern in place. The other thing there is, what was that Nitro rating again?
3.1. This is for a 1 hour show at 7 p.m.
Yeah, just think about a 1 hour show at 7 p.m. outside of their normal time slot, and they'd been doing mid to high twos in the build up to that last hour. I wonder how much of that plays into sort of viewing habits of people at the time.
Absolutely, yeah, it's viewing habits.
And I just think it does sort of contrast there how much of a role WCW's on, in the sense that they can get ratings above a 3 in a lesser time slot, if you like. It's just sort of outside of that prime time mold. Yeah. And it just sort of shows, it just again emphasises how hot of a company they'd become.
Shawn Michaels and his dad had a meeting with Vince McMahon at Titan Towers at Vince's request. Michaels became at odds with Vince by demanding a new contract that would put his pay at the same level as Bret Hart. When McMahon turned down his demands, he gave his notice to the company wanting to join his real friends in WCW, saying that if he went to WCW, he could be set for life. With 4 years remaining on his contract, McMahon refused, and the general attitude during the week was that they have no idea where Michaels' head is anymore. Michaels rubbed a lot of people the wrong way backstage at Raw by complaining about having to do that interview putting Ken Shamrock over.
Just to talk about the inside nature of the business, there was a Shawn is a quitter sign in the crowd that
really?
Next week. Yep.
Very interesting. Well, that was an ECW fan with that one. Consequently, the match with Bret Hart, King of the Ring, was scrapped this week, largely due to Bret Hart being unable to make it back in time from his injury, but obviously there's uncertainty about Shawn as well. Several people close to Bret are saying that Bret is actually, when he gets the chance, going to punch Shawn Michaels out due to that sunny days comment. More on that later. We go to May 26th, the first head-to-head show in a month. One of the best Raw shows ever, with a hot crowd and great angles all the way through and an excellent main event title change. Steve Austin and Shawn Michaels versus Owen and Davey in one of my favourite matches during 1997. Fantastic match. Shawn just looks like he just fucking rolled out of bed after having just being full-time and just puts on a great performance here.
Genius.
Yeah, star of the match, honestly. I think he's so good.
I mean, he hits the ropes at like twice the speed of everyone else.
Yeah.
He's amazing.
Yeah. Austin attacks Bret after the title change. There's the great scene where the Hart Foundation's attacking Shawn. Austin's on the outside, just doesn't give a fuck, looks at Bret on his own and goes and gets him.
Well, he's walking off anyway to start with. He's walking off, then he sees Bret and then he charges him to shut out of his knee again.
Yeah, he's shut out of his knee. Which ends up being the excuse to take him out of the King of the Ring.
And I just want to, I'm maybe giving the company too much credit here, but you can and you can shoot this down if you think so. But again, it's just that sense of tying into that realism, because why would Steve Austin go and protect Shawn Michaels? Why would he be ultra babyface? He wouldn't, you know. If it's someone in, you know, if it's me or you or anyone else, and it's someone we don't like, and we see the person that we've actually really got an issue with, you know, that would be the natural reaction, be the more human reaction.
No, I think you're totally right. I think they were. I'll give them credit because they were totally being faithful to the Austin character.
Steve Austin suffered a neck injury during this match, but it wasn't clear how serious or if he'll miss any time over it. It's a tidbit for later on. Also got to mention on the show the Jerry Lawler Goldust situation on this show. this is just great, just because Lawler's the complete and utter babyface and rifles off a promo that would not fly today at all.
Is it in Indianapolis?
It's in Indiana.
Indiana. So
it's on the outskirts of where they used to run in Memphis.
WA, yeah. He's a babyface to the crowd anyway. And then he cuts his promo. It's just he's like Stone Cold Jerry Lawler, basically.
He really is.
He's just so hot and firing. He calls Goldust, you know, the reference to the old interview when he asked him if he was queer.
Yeah.
And he just basically disses him, so you walk around like a flaming fag or
something. Yeah,
like
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
Just a crowd, and the crowd, you hear the crowd pop in the background.
Yeah.
And when he comes out for the match, he's a total babyface.
Total babyface, cheats to win with his feet on the ropes, and the crowd explodes when he gets the win. So this whole Goldust thing, an anomaly maybe in terms of the audience, but that doesn't seem to be clicking too well here against Jerry Lawler.
They just love Jerry, I think.
I think they just loved. Yeah, they did just love Jerry, no matter what he did.
But was this after, though, they'd brought out Dakota? Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Oh, God, that's terrible.
Yeah, it's rotten stuff.
Yeah, so that didn't help Goldust in this match, I don't think, either. But Jerry was just the king. So.
Yeah, Jerry was great.
Well, that's Vince's old habits, isn't it? We talk about the humanising of a character. Let's have him bring out the whole family, because everyone's going to get behind that. Oh, wait, this
worked for Ricky Steamboat, didn't it?
Worked for, yeah, well.
Okay, you may remember I mentioned somebody's name that was signed to the company on the last episode, and I said it'll tie back to this. This is stunning. Paul Bearer came out to reveal the secret, the Undertaker's secret, and got as far as saying he was the funeral director at the Undertaker's parents' funeral. However, at the funeral, there were not just two graves, there were three. Taker came out to attack Paul Bearer at this point and then bowed down, and Bearer will now manage him. The story will be that the third grave was the Undertaker's, but that Papa Shango did some kind of voodoo to raise the Undertaker from the dead, which will explain his return, as Shango has signed a 4-year contract and will get a mega push.
I was absolutely terrified. I mean, when you reminded us then about someone you'd referenced before, I thought, please don't say he's going to mention Papa Shango now. Please don't tell me the intention was to actually bring him back as Papa Shango.
Yeah, it was. That was the entire idea of the secret, was to build a Papa Shango. In 1997.
It's just...
against the backdrop of real Mick Foley, real Goldust, Steve Austin.
After all we've talked about, not just in the...
Kieran's mouth hasn't closed yet.
We just... after all we've talked about during this podcast and the way we've credited WCW for that sense of realism, given Vince credit because he's at least appreciated that this is the way it has to go, whether or not it's the direction he wants, he's at least accepting it and he's trying to humanise characters. After all the credit we give them there, it just goes to show the son of a bitch just cannot let old habits die, can he?
No.
He just always pulled back to this cartoon era. He just can't quite break free from it.
Are you sure? Are you sure this isn't Meltzer putting two and two together?
No, apparently that was the... And there is something stemming from this later on that will make more sense out of this. But,
fuck
well,
me.
No, it won't. But you'll see where this goes, basically.
Fuck my arse.
Absolutely shocked that they would want to bring Papa Shango back in
1997. It was such a raging success the first time.
What was wrong with Karma, the Supreme Fighter Machine? Because, you know, those two had a great feud.
Bring him in for Shamrock.
Jesus.
Talk about fucking Hobson's choice. Jesus Christ. We've talked family, we've talked Pillman with a gun, you know, we've talked home invasions over these podcasts, and he's bring back fucking Papa Shango.
So the secret was, you actually did die.
He did die, he was actually a dead man, and Shango...
The secret is, your gimmick's real.
Yeah.
Okay. Actually dead.
Yeah.
Oh, the old electricity and setting co-workers on fire doesn't seem quite so bad now, does it?
No.
But what's the point in that? There is like a question Mel's putting two together, because what the fuck? Who cares?
Yeah. I don't know.
Reaching
for anything, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. So hang on. So he'd feud with Shango because he brought him back to life.
Apparently.
Shouldn't he be
thankful?
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah.
Anyway, May 26th.
Dead people, we don't know what they're like, do we?
Yeah.
Good point.
Over on Nitro, countering this, the Great Muta joins the New World Order, teaming up with Chono, who'd also joined. The show finishes with Hogan and Bischoff yelling about Sting. A fake Sting comes up from under the ring and then bows down to Hulk Hogan, who was being humiliated until the real Sting came from the ceiling and dropped Bischoff once again. Hogan ran off without being touched, and Sting then laid out the imposter. The entire NWO came out to attack Sting, and Sting was supposed to fly with the rope back up to the ceiling, but the timing was screwed up, and the NWO guys all had to stand there like idiots and not attack him, even though they had an 8-on-1 advantage until he got himself hooked up. A little bit of a miscommunication there, timing-wise, with there. But again, we're seeing this, there's not really much else to say on these Nitros. It seems like this is a very WWF centric quarter that we're talking about, but it's because Hogan's not on any of these pay-per-views, so it's very much holding pattern here.
This plays in a little bit to what I talked about on our last podcast about build-ups and why I wasn't necessarily as big a fan of this Sting one as others might be. I mean, like I said at the time, can't argue with the success of it ultimately, and the crowd reactions for this, they are going absolutely apeshit. But even so, to me, it's this rinse and repeat pattern. You know, it's Sting Bischoff for the third or fourth time, and it's just sort of, there's no evolution to the storyline. It doesn't go on from anywhere for so long. I think that's what I find great, and I think to an extent why I didn't so much mind the teasing of dissension initially, because at least it was something a little bit different.
The one thing that really works in Sting's favour is it seems like he's the only babyface who doesn't get outsmarted and laid out by the NWO every week. He's, you know, actually he's a smart babyface.
Yeah. Flair gets one win, Charlotte gets the shit down the next night. Yeah.
So Sting's the only one who sustained success against the NWO. So
for the head-to-head clash here, the ratings are in: 3.3 for Nitro towards 2.8. Raw won the last quarter hour with the Bearer Secret and the main event tag. WCW win the other seven quarters, of course.
From the last time where they were competing, they have actually narrowed the gap.
They've narrowed the gap a little bit.
So okay, it wasn't probably... The 4 weeks probably wasn't as successful as they were hoping, as they didn't overtake them, but they certainly, you know, gained some ground, so...
Absolutely. We'll see how long that sustains.
They won a couple of battles.
We've got something, if we can just channel it properly. And you mentioned there, they won the last quarter, but Austin's involved in the last quarter. You mentioned previously that... they'd had their first quarter win in a while with
the Barrett Street fight.
Steve Austin. They can obviously tell from that they are on to something.
On that note, a note in the Observer here, the Austin 316 t-shirt, like the Sting t-shirt, is going through the roof. The WWF is selling more Austin shirts than any wrestler in the history of the promotion, and that includes Hogan and Warrior in their primes. It single-handedly sparked merchandise sales to new records, and that's already. So just to go to your point, Carl and Gianna, you want to chime in here on Steve Austin being a success even this early.
And just quickly, you'll notice on the TV as well, after Chase little interest you, the only use of women on the show, apart from Marlena and China, was to walk out wearing an Undertaker t-shirt.
Oh, Sable?
Yes, and Sunny as well, or the Raw t-shirt, and now it's actually the Austin one rather than the Taker one.
I guess probably feeding the audience that there's a storyline that is progressing from week to week to week, as opposed to with WCW, where, from your own words, Liam, you said they're on a holding pattern right now. WCW, you've just seen something happen week in, week out, whilst with us, there's actually an investment in storyline. There is actually a soap opera. It's rather than just using those 4 weeks as a hot shot and try and get high ratings, which may or may not
mean anything when they go
mean
back,
anything
head
when they go back together. They try to invest and try and build a little bit and try and get the viewers in the future.
Yeah, I see what you mean there.
It is this, that they are in a holding pattern phase, and for a few reasons, because we've already referenced there, they've got that series of 1 hour shows, they're being preempted for the NBA playoffs, so they're a victim of the network schedule as it is, so there's not going to be an awful lot going on because everything's been condensed into this 1 hour. So there is only going to be one or two sort of prominent players, if you like.
Brian Pillman is in tremendous pain after wrestling on his bad ankle for the first time, and has been any time he's had to do anything active on his leg. We were talking off air a little bit about how Brian Pillman probably should have been a manager at this point in time. Unfortunate foreshadowing here in the Observer about the obviously the fate of Brian Pillman. But I thought he was great in the role. Like we mentioned before, that prayer promo on Raw, but I just thought him as just the fucking antagonist, the little shit disturber. He was great in the role of the Hart Foundation. And I just didn't think he needed to wrestle. And they had him wrestle. I understand why, because it's a name and he had momentum and stuff, but man, it felt like it wasn't needed. And obviously when you look at what ends up happening, it especially comes off like it wasn't needed.
And at the end of the day, they signed him to a guaranteed contract for a large sum of money. Yeah. And so it is incredibly sad because it's sort of the, it's really the peaks and troughs. Because he's such a good talker, he's such a great instigator. As you say, he's the perfect shit stirrer, the perfect mouthpiece for the Hart Foundation. Which, whilst Brett is, has found his sort of built his momentum back from coming back at the end of '96, and really found his niche with the promos he's cutting now. He's not, a 10 out of 10 promo. It was the perfect role for him, and it was something that they needed as well. And then to go from that, where he excels so much, to see him just not even be a shadow of what he used to be, through no fault of his own, obviously, it's just, it's quite sad. And it, as you say, it becomes even sadder when you go skip ahead a bit and see what ultimately transpires.
Watching Pillman when he's first matched, it's him
and Anvil against LOD, right?
It's so sad. And then even more so when he's in with Austin, and it's one on one, because obviously taking away the fact he passed away, if he hadn't have died and if he could go, God, he could have. It'd been interesting in how far he'd have gone during that era, because him and Austin were. I mean, he was up there with Austin in terms of it, just dynamic, fantastic, engaging promos. So what he could have become if what happened hadn't have happened, I think he would have had a massive, massive future.
Yeah, it's such a shame, because obviously the other thing you got to put into factor is Brian Pillman's personal pride as well at this point, where he wanted to continue wrestling. He wasn't going to, he didn't want to be the kind of manager, he wanted to still be Flying Brian, I guess.
But we've talked on previous episodes about the buyer's remorse with Bret Hart. There was no fucking way they would have suggested not to try to come back.
They wanted all the mileage they could get.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Speaking of injury, Sid was supposed to return at the house show on May 30th, but now claims to have the flu. I know what you're thinking, and so is everyone else, as Dave Meltzer. Guess the softball team must have made the playoffs.
Yeah, I was just about to say, it's baseball season.
It's softball season, it's the same period every year. Have you not noticed the pattern in Sid's career? It's from April to June, July.
And I was all ready to break out the softball song from The Simpsons there before you referenced it. Damn it.
I'm about to end the show. The June 2nd Raw. The show opens with The Undertaker and Paul Bearer. Bearer made a comment about ruling the world, which brought Sid out to set up the main event, so he got over his flu quite quick. Taker beat Sid in the main event clean in 5 minutes. Sid showed up at the building and said he didn't want to do the job. He was given some threats as to future employment and finally agreed to do it. Right.
Yeah, I didn't like this. Because he came out talking about he hadn't had his rematch since he dropped the title, so he was going to have his rematch tonight. So I thought, it was a title match before Taker ran before King of the Ring. But he wasn't. It was just a regular match.
It was a regular match, non-title, and he lost anyway in 5 minutes.
Thanks, Sid.
Thanks for coming. The big angle on the show, obviously, is the changes announced to the King of the Ring pay-per-view this Sunday, with Steve Austin and Shawn Michaels is now the match they're going to go with, since they're not going to do Shawn and Brett or Pillman and Austin.
I said on the show, was this the show, Shawn and Steve Austin versus LOD?
Yeah.
When Austin and Shawn were heel.
Yeah.
Oh, I fucking love it. It's just for perverse value. That match is fantastic.
But that weird seeing this out of place kind of thing, look at this.
But it's like, obviously Austin can get away with it because he's just like raking the eyes and low blows and all sorts. But Shawn working heel as well, and them as a team, it's fantastic.
Yeah, it's great to see.
Fantastic.
Over on Nitro, we have a Ric Flair Scott Hall main event. They build up pretty much the whole night, and Savage attacks JJ Dillon. So it didn't take long for JJ to get laid out here as the babyface authority figure. Nitro gets a 3.4 to Raw's 2.5, so it's already dropped from the previous week, unfortunately. For the final quarter, when the WWF had The Undertaker versus Sid, WCW more than doubled the 2.3 rating that Raw did for that quarter hour. So Sid is ratings poison. He's awful. He's buy rate poison. Why is he around? He's a fucking pain in the ass.
There is a reason why during that Raw intro it shows a picture of Sid and then bombs dropping.
This week's Weekly Variety had a story on the Monday Night Wars. McMahon and TNT president Brad Siegel both admitted that their television shows are money losers despite their ratings. So it was a little factoid there. Although television has historically always been a loss leader for pay-per-view and house shows, and house shows are doing extremely well during this period of time for both companies.
Take it, Dixie Carter. I never read that article.
I'm assuming, I don't know, she can read. To be quite honest.
Touché.
The WCW interview rule is that Flair, Piper and Hogan can't be referred to as old, but Flair and Piper can be called fossils.
Yeah, because it's not as old.
Don't ask me. The original idea of the Paul Bearer surprise has now been changed, and Papa Shango won't be part of the angle. No longer Papa Shango. Thank God.
Yay.
Yeah, it's going to get so much better. The WWF put tickets on sale for an August date in Boston. Sid was supposed to do a lot of the media work in town, but no showed all of it.
I think he's a good thing, obviously.
Steve Austin was told this week that the injury that was suffered in the tag title match with that we mentioned before, Austin and Shawn versus Davey and Owen, could be the beginning of a serious neck problem, and the doctor suggested he retire. This is before the Owen driver, just as a curious thing. He's going for a second opinion, however. We move to June 8th, King of the Ring, 9,312 fans in a 16,000-seat building, a 0.46... for 129,000 buys, the lowest buy rate of the year so far.
And that explains why Farouk never... no, this was...
He can't take the bullet on this
he absolutely can't. But it's a real strange show to me when you think about it. Because we referenced Ahmed Johnson earlier, who was initially going to be in the role of challenger to Undertaker, who... loses in the semi-finals of the King of the Ring to Triple H,
yeah,
clean, because Ahmed's not having no bitch hit him. You know, for them to have, you know, so you think about that. He's,
his words, not Carl's, by the way.
Yes, just for clarification.
I just love the way Carl said it, though.
To then have Ahmed do the running at the end, to do the Pearl River Plunge on Undertaker, Michaels and Austin, which... the way it's sort of talked about throughout the pay-per-view and in the weeks building up, really, is the real main event to me of this show. Third match from the top, I think, is the way it pans out, because you obviously have the King of the Ring and then you have the dud of a main event. Other than that, it's actually quite a piss-poor card on top of that as well, if I'm not mistaken, if there's anything that you'd like to read out from it.
Triple H wins the King of the Ring. Interesting note, Helmsley was eliminated in a television qualifying match, but due to the injuries to Vader at Cold Day in Hell, they had to rework the entire tournament, and there were several changes in plan, so Helmsley was not only put back in the tournament, but given the crown. The final four was supposed to be Ahmed versus Vader and Goldust versus Savio, with Ahmed winning the tournament. It does beg the question why they didn't just have Ahmed win the tournament, since the idea was going to be to go to him and Taker anyway. So you can only surmise they thought, well, he's going to attack Taker and feud with him, so he doesn't need to win King of the Ring. That's the only thing I can... which is stupid, but it's the only thing I can pull away from it, because they clearly, when you look at this, not only the angle at the end, but what they do going forward on Raw, Ahmed was big in the plans. Helmsley was not.
I could surmise that maybe Shawn Michaels had a role in that, maybe.
Possibly in terms of getting Triple H more prominently featured, but certainly not in terms of having Ahmed Johnson do a job. Like I say, it's just a strange show. There's no rhyme or reason to any of it. The Pillman promo in the men's room, which Austin just happens to be walking past and creeps up on him.
Yeah, flushes his head down the toilet. And
that's the one.
So this one got a
0.46, lowest buy rate of the year.
Off the top of your head, how was that in comparison to the last two King of the Rings?
The 96 did a 0.6 and 95 did a 0.65. This one's the lowest King of the Ring of the last 3 years.
Jesus.
You know, you've got a WWF champion who's only being treated as the sort of the second rung, if you like. He's not prominently featured. His title run's not meaning anything in the grand scheme of things. Then you've got the Austin Shawn match, who whilst they feature prominently on TV, it's very much a last minute booking thing because of injuries and just the way the company's look was going with their roster and their health at the time. So it's not that surprising, really, in that sense, to see a buy rate such as that.
It's the story of the last 6 months of every plan they tried to put together falling apart, having to make makeshift cards. There might have only been like one or two pay-per-views so far this year where the cards ended up exactly as they wanted them to be.
Yeah, I suppose that's the best way to look at it. It's very much a microcosm of all the problems they've had up to this point.
The only thing I'll say on
Triple H winning was, over the past couple of months, he had started getting some momentum in the eyes of the, rather than just being this bland
Nick Card for life guy.
Yeah, people did care when him and China walked out, maybe more China than him.
Honestly, I think it was China.
Yeah, but at least the act had a bit of attention, people cared about it, and a bit of notoriety with China, so that was probably in his favour.
Obviously, it's part of the Mick Foley babyface turn as it progresses as well here as we go forward.
Yeah, a wonderful effort from Mick Foley to help put Triple H over and give China some of the rub there.
We move to June 9th, a day I can't wait to talk about, the day the shit hits the fan. At approximately 7:20 p.m. in Shawn Michaels' dressing room, Bret Hart was screaming about how Shawn Michaels' comments affected his personal life and crossed the line. Shawn Michaels was a smart ass back, so the two went at it, and it's believed to be a one-sided short tussle, which resulted in a few punches thrown and a large clump of Michael's hair being pulled out of his head. Michael's face was all puffed up from the punches and he was bleeding from the elbow. Michael's was going crazy after the predicament and said he would never work against anyone in the Hart Foundation again because he couldn't trust them, and ended up walking out of the building claiming he couldn't work or stay in this kind of an environment just before the show was scheduled to go on the air at 7:57. At this point, the entire television show had to be scrapped and a new show put together literally minutes before it went on the air. On his way out, Shawn said that if he could make it to Boston on time, which is where Nitro is being held this night, he'd just as soon go there, and told McMahon, "I'll never work for your fucking ass again." Bret Hart left the arena at 8:30 without appearing on the television show.
Jim Cornette thanks them for the hair, by the way.
Yeah. And it is, although it's not, you know, it's within the existing storylines. Anyway, it was actually acknowledged on the air, wasn't it?
Afterwards they acknowledged it. There was a tussle.
It was right at the end of the show, I think, because I thought I'd missed the segment when I was watching it. They actually acknowledged there's an unprofessional confrontation in which Bret Hart was the aggressor and Shawn had suffered a knee injury, and Bret had also aggravated his knee injury as well. That's why both guys weren't there after being sent home. Vince probably loving it secretly.
Yeah. This is going fucking great. This is
fucking stonking hard on.
Just talk about the actual Raw, because there's more turmoil to come on this day. Austin hurt his knee the previous night, and with Shawn Michaels leaving the building, they did a Mankind Brian Pillman main event, which felt very kind of rushed and out of nowhere. Rob Van Dam versus Flash Funk on the show to continue the Mr. Monday Night stuff. Heyman and Dreamer hopped the rail to go after Lawler and RVD because Lawler had shown up in ECW the prior weekend. Farouk did an interview where he fired everyone in the Nation of Domination except D'Lo Brown, and challenged The Undertaker and Ahmed Johnson to a tag match for next week, where nearly everyone expects Ahmed to turn on The Undertaker.
And the new Nation is going to be bigger, badder and blacker.
The final part of the Mankind interview is shown here as well, with the Mandible Claw and Jim Ross. So again, just continuing like we said, that the slow burn. Over on Nitro, they broke the all-time WCW attendance record. 18,003 fans sell out the Boston Fleet Center. Jeff Jarrett wins the United States title from Dean Malenko on this show. Here's another one. Lex Luger beats Hulk Hogan clean with a torture rack in 6 minutes. Non-title. Obviously, this is that, you know, Luger's trying to get a title match here. I guess at the end, they know Sting's long-term. We need something in the interim. Luger is the choice. And this gets a great reaction here. He pretty much wipes out the whole NWO by himself and gets the rack. Although, in the end, Hogan, of course, beats him down.
Yeah, more importantly, Hogan's working.
He's working on TV again.
Well, he's there.
Although WCW, we reference that, has had some problems during this quarter with Piper and Flair and Nash and all the sort of shenanigans that are going on there with the shoot comments in their promos. Pales in comparison to the problems WWF has with the Hart and Michaels tussle, complete rewrite of the show, and then the same week WCW breaks their attendance record at the Fleet Center.
And you got to think from a Hogan perspective too, he wanted to be on the show that did the all-time attendance record, so there's political motivations there as well. Let's not ignore that.
He's a smart fucker.
He's not smart.
but it just shows any minor problems that WCW have at this point pale in comparison to the issues that WWF is still facing.
Well, on that note, the main event of this show is Roddy Piper and Ric Flair against Hall and Nash. Nash claimed that Piper wasn't doing what they agreed on doing, although Nash also didn't appear to want to sell much for Piper in the corner. They were supposed to get the heat on Piper to build to Flair's hot tag, but Piper looked horrible and the match was killed. Piper also called for the finish way early, 6 minutes into a match scheduled for 12, which meant that the post-match brawl to end the show lasted forever. This was the company-wide brawl where pretty much everybody comes out and fights in the aisle, in the ring, at the stand. Sting comes from the ceiling and hooks up DDP and flies up to the ceiling with him to close the show. If you remember that, it's the sign of DDP horizontally floating up to the ceiling.
Yeah, it's just like freaking like Batman and Vicky Vale. It's just, like, just flying up into the fucking trap.
After the show, Nash went to Piper's private dressing room, kicked the door down, started screaming and swearing at him about the match, and Pie faced Piper, shoving him up against the wall. Piper tried to kick Nash's bad knee before Craig Malley and Ric Flair acted as peacemakers and quickly broke it up before anything serious took place. So on the same day here, backstage fights in WWF and WCW, all the heat that's been building up between these two sides. We mentioned even in the last episode the sides being drawn between the Sullivan camp and the Hogan camp. It's blowing up here on both sides. An interesting note from Meltzer Hibben, which sums it up. The stars are clearly above the rules. It's no secret within the industry, and it's caused a cancer in both dressing rooms when the business is being run to appease a few people's egos or to maximize the power certain wrestlers have backstage rather than for the maximum gain of all. Ironically, business is the strongest it's been in years since this is going on. So you got, again, unfortunately, to me, that's the interesting parallel.
But again, in the case of WCW, obviously my point notwithstanding then about drops in the ocean is clearly incorrect as we get to the end of that show.
Nitro did a 3.4 this week to Raw's 2.2. So things went straight back down with the makeshift Raw. One day later, Vince McMahon sent an internal memo to the WWF executive saying, last night in Hartford, Shawn Michaels breached his contract by refusing to perform. The door is open for Shawn to return under the terms of his contract. Shawn Michaels also disconnected his telephone, making it impossible for them to contact him and smooth things over right after this happened. By the end of the week, Michaels' attorney sent the WWF a letter saying that Michaels hadn't breached his contract, but that he was just injured in the fight with Hart, claiming both knee and neck injuries, and that he'd be unable to wrestle for 4 to 6 more weeks. He's only been back for like 3 matches and he's already gone. He requested a meeting with McMahon in San Antonio for both sides to settle their differences, and the WWF is now making plans with the idea that Michaels will be back at the later part of July.
But again, it emphasises the complete contrast to what you'd historically seen with promoters having all this power, and just, you know, any other time a wrestler would have been shit-canned for pulling a stunt like that. But we're in a war.
Showing up on TV, pilled up.
Yeah, we've got so many problems here. We're losing money in the case of WWF, and just goes to show the leverage that the wrestlers have at this point. Because, you know, what can Vince do? He can't fire Shawn. If he fires Shawn, Shawn can go and walk over to WCW, which only exacerbates Vince's bigger problem.
It's 1997. You're a booker of a company. Which two talents would you rather deal with, Hogan and Nash, or Shawn and Bret?
For me personally, I go with Bret and Shawn, for the sole reason that neither of them have complete creative control.
Yeah, agree.
For the sake of trying to make money in 97, I'd probably go with Hogan and Nash.
Because Bret's injured and Shawn's leaving.
Sources in ECW say that it'll be Van Damme and Sabu versus Dreamer and Sandman at SummerSlam.
Fucking Dreamer.
Sources in the WWF say that it is better than 50% that an ECW match will be taking place at SummerSlam, but that it's tentatively scheduled as Lawler and Van Damme versus Dreamer and Sandman. So there's an interesting little tidbit there. ECW is supposed to have a presence at the second biggest pay-per-view of the year.
And either way, Kieran, you're getting Dreamer.
Dreamer waddling down ringside with his fucking fat man jeans pulled up to his belly button. I hate this guy, I really do.
Well, thankfully, it wouldn't happen, and we'll get to why very soon.
Huzzah!
For the most part, people throughout WCW are being very complimentary for the job Terry Taylor is doing as the booker in Sullivan's absence. Sullivan showed up at Raw because it was in Boston, which was a huge deal personally to him, but it's expected that he'll be gone again for a few weeks before resurfacing. The word came down from the top that Ted Turner wants no more words like ass or damn used in WCW. Kurt Hennig will debut on the June 30th Nitro from Las Vegas, but they are working on a much bigger name from the real world, not a wrestler, as the big surprise. But there are so many variables regarding that person that it may not happen.
Was it The Miz?
It wasn't The Miz, no. But Hennig, after much jockeying for almost a year at this point, will be finally debuting. But yeah, there's another big surprise in the works. Steve Austin got a second opinion from a doctor this week who told me he didn't need the surgery. His injury has been diagnosed as a severe erosion of the neck vertebrae. Again,
that sounds good.
This is before the pile driver. So this is Austin was his body was starting to fail him a little bit here. He had a knee injury as well at King of the Ring. So yeah, not doing too well. Sid, Flash Funk, Furnace, and LaFon were involved in a car wreck on June 15th. Sid was driving a rented Lincoln Continental at 100 miles an hour and apparently was adjusting the sunroof when the car went out of control, hit the shoulder on the road, and rolled 4 times. Yeah, I know. Sid was hospitalized this past week due to new problems in his back, and there's no word on when he'll return. Again, more time off for Sid. And this one actually is actually real. So, June 15th to go to the WCW Great American Bash. 9,613 fans in the building. A 0.6 buy rate for 168,000 buys. Notable just because none of the buy rates during this quarter have been all that impressive, despite the fact that momentum is pretty good for both companies. From a house show perspective, which we haven't touched on, the house show numbers are through the roof. The TV ratings are pretty good. They're steady, consistent in the same ballpark they've been. But the buy rates are less impressive than they were in 1995, funnily enough.
Though I'm curious, given this period, what was the main event on the bash again? Was that the
Savage DDP rematch? Savage DDP.
So the telling thing here is, though, whilst the buy rates aren't out of this world by any means, don't get me wrong, it's three shows with no Hogan and no WCW title defense.
Yeah.
And we can say what we want about the significance of belts as we go through this era, and certainly as you go into the future, but at that point it still means something to have, you know, the belt as a draw, and to have the top guy in the promotion, regardless of your views of Hogan, on the card. So to not have him there is only going to serve to hurt the buy rate.
Absolutely, yeah. Randy Savage pins DDP in the main event, gets his win back, although it is with the assistance of Scott Hall. Nash and Hall beat Flair and Piper. They do get their win back too from Slammery. Flair chases Six to the back and left Piper on his own to lose. The original plan was for Flair and Piper to turn on each other at the finish, but it was changed because the company felt too many people knew about it. I don't know who that possibly could have been in 1997 with the internet being what it was. We move to the next night because there's nothing else of real historical significance on that pay-per-view. June 16th, Raw. The WWF decided against using Bret Hart on the live show for fear that he might say something that Shawn Michaels would take the wrong way on a live interview. Yeah. A tag tournament begins here to determine the challenges against Austin and a partner of his choice, since they have absolutely no idea what's going on with the tag titles and Shawn at this point.
Yeah, this is where they start with Mankind starts his pitch to become Steve Austin's partner, yeah, with his Pick Me Steve sign, and I think it's the week after with the wearing the Austin 316 shirt. And I think it probably is the next week actually of this, when Mankind's out again with the Pick Me Steve and the Austin t-shirt, and Austin's on the phone. And he wants to give a shout out to his brother Kevin, who stamped on by a bull. He says, "Normally I wouldn't give a damn, but he owes me $30, so get back to work soon, Kev."
also on this show, we have Austin versus Brian Pillman with the Hart Foundation handcuffed at ringside. This is the match you alluded to earlier, Kieran, where it's sad watching Austin's Pillman's nose gets busted in this match as well, but he looks like he's struggling to run, struggling to move. His bump is awkward. It's a sad sight to see, unfortunately. It ends with Austin and Shamrock brawling, and obviously the rest of the babyfaces, Goldust and the LOD, come in, and the Canadian Stampede team is made, and the main event is set for that show. The main event is Farouk and the new member of the Nation, Karma Mustafa, not Papa Shango, defeating The Undertaker and Ahmed Johnson with, if you recall, Karma pinning The Undertaker clean with a uranage in the middle of the ring, which was the concession for not doing the Papa Shango Taker feud. They gave him a clean win over Undertaker on Raw to make up for it.
But if I'm not mistaken, the way they tried to get around this clean win on commentary is to reference that Ahmed is never tagged in at any point.
Ahmed doesn't tag in. He's in the wrong place for the tags. Ahmed turns on him after the match with the Pearl River Plunge and joins the Nation of Domination. So that's the four-man Nation: D'Lo, Farouk, Ahmed, and Karma Mustafa. Ahmed resisted the idea of turning heel, it should be noted, and there's more on that, but
D'Lo's got his work cut out for him there, making that team look good.
The crowd was so silent when Karma pinned Taker. It's ridiculous.
It was up there with Carly beating Taker with the chop for me.
Yeah.
Just what the fuck?
Yeah. No recollection of that
lot. No, I honestly didn't. I had no watching back, I had no recollection of that happening. And it's understandable why, because probably erased it from my memory.
I think because it's so sort of out of left field is the reason why I remember it crystal clear. I remember it vividly. It was so shocking to see at the time. In particular, the Ahmed heel turn, because it was teased, and you knew it was going to come eventually, but it just, in the sense of seeing his feud with the Nation to that, and the way that they were sort of really going to the races with the with sort of the racial overtones involved with the group now, the four of them doing the Nation salute on the top of the ramp, and you think we are really getting into some grey areas, let's say, now with the way that this is portrayed. I can't think of the word I want to say, because we talk about realism and grittiness. It's really contrasting to what we're used to historically from the company.
Yeah, contrast us with 1 year prior, and it stands out like a sore thumb. It's amazing. I like this group, though. I like the visual of them. They look like badass motherfuckers, especially the next week when they come out all dressed in black. Oh, but yeah. More on that later, because on Nitro the same day, June 16th, Dennis Rodman returns. The show opened with Hogan and Rodman challenging Luger and the Giant for later that show, which they continue to use throughout Nitro. Rodman was clearly up to speed as he referred to Luger as Lex Luthor several times. At match time, Hogan hit Luger with a belt and Giant had Rodman up for the chokeslam, but Hogan hit him with a belt as well. Hall, Nash and Six, and later Savage, all come out and they end up spray-painting NWO on Luger and Giant's back while the ring fills up with debris. The angle got super heat and was great when it comes to building the pay-per-view, and finally we have a direction here with Hogan that is short-term based. Hogan, Robin versus Luger and Giant is coming at the Bash at the Beach. Good stuff here, I thought, actually. Really good show in terms of building the heat. Nitro 3.3 towards 2.4, so it didn't take long for things to settle right back to where they previously were. There is no word on what the situation really is with Shawn Michaels. The scheduled meeting in San Antonio between Vince and Michaels' attorney was cancelled. The WWF has hired a new announcer named Michael Cole! Don't know anything about Cole, but reports we heard was that it was obvious he didn't know very much.
Well,
hasn't changed.
18 years later.
The WWF, despite the common perception of it being the number two company, is still on a consistent basis outdrawing WCW at the arena events, although WCW has a higher sellout percentage based on the fact they're running smaller buildings. So, June 23rd on Nitro, Flair and Piper do a weird angle where they end up turning on each other after all. At first, they're both making cracks, buttering each other up, saying they're best friends, until McMichael, Deborah, and Benoit come out and they begin running Piper down. Flair tries to act like the peacemaker between the two sides. Piper attacks Benoit, and it wound up with Flair helping his fellow horseman and turning on Piper. This is where Flair starts jumping around the ring maniacally like a little child, stamping on the cameras because he's back to the old nature boy. He starts strutting in the ring. Even though he's kind of somewhat turned heel, they're still cheering for him like crazy, so what the hell. Scott Hall, Diamond Dallas Page main event with a Savage running and Sting makes the save. So again, similar story to what we've seen previously here. Over on Raw, obviously we mentioned the Nation of Domination promo to start the show, which leads to the debut of the DOA, my least favourite group in wrestling history besides the Cabinet maybe.
They get a pop.
The bikes get a pop. Come on, surely it's the bikes.
And where was this? What part of the country?
I don't know. I can't remember off the top of my head. Oh, it's Detroit. Is it Detroit? I want to say it's Cobo Hall.
I think it is Detroit, actually, yeah.
Yeah, Motor City, so maybe there you go, I don't know.
Well, yeah, but it's like the Nation in the ring with Vince, and Ahmed, well, you know, if you could understand him.
Which was a challenge during this.
Yeah, so, and not they're you know, really heelish with Vince. And then like the white team comes out, and it's like, oh, God.
The bikers, biker gang.
Yeah.
And it's like, what a week to be talking about this fine line, by the way.
Yeah,
just,
I know.
Just nuts. There was actually talk about making the Nation of Domination into babyfaces because Ahmed Johnson didn't want to turn heel. They were actually going to turn the Nation babyface.
I was going to say, he did look really uncomfortable, I thought.
Yeah, absolutely uncomfortable. The decision to actually keep them heel was because Ahmed got so much heel heat at the house shows over the weekend that the idea was dropped, and they're now making it a heavily racial gimmick. At this point, you got to Ahmed accusing Vince of why have I never got a title shot? You know,
why you never back me up?
Yeah,
my crew backed me up.
He talks about, you know, Martin Luther King was a nice guy. What happened to him? Yeah. Really, they're laying it on thick here.
Well, I thought it was really good though.
I thought it was really good. It's like it's forgotten, and I'm not trying to make out this is the Four Horsemen or anything here. But it's just like, in terms of seeds of something that could develop. Yeah, it's walking a bit of a dodgy line in some respects, but. Yeah, it's being executed well, at least. During the brawl with the DOA, Ahmed blows out his knee and needs surgery and is now out of his pay-per-view main event. So thank you very much. Another great thing the Harris boys contributed to the wrestling business. So that's the end of Ahmed's push once again.
And again, I mentioned roster health there before, and it just, you know, whenever it seems, I'm not sure, you'll probably tell me with the numbers here in terms of the ratings, but whenever it seems they've got an idea in mind or something to really go off to the races with, an injury strikes.
The main event is Taker and Vader against Farouk and D'Lo, replacing Ahmed, who was injured. Paul Bearer said he will reveal the surprise next week since Taker turned on him and Vader during the match. Bret Hart also returns on Raw this week and does an angle with Thomas Hitman Hearns, who decks Neidhart, consequently. It doesn't mention Sean at all at Vince's insistence once again. Other thing of note here is Sabu goes to a double countout with Flash Funk.
And Vince verbally hates this.
Tell he doesn't like it.
Yeah.
Really, really kind of weird, especially when Sabu can't break the table.
Yeah,
it's like, what is this?
Yeah, you just know what he's thinking. Fucking, what is this fucking shit?
why am I dedicating this much time to this?
Yeah,
Nitro does a 3.2 towards 2.4 this week, so both numbers actually a little bit down. part of the reason why Vince was probably not impressed, earlier that day, Rob Van Dam was supposed to lose to Jesse James on Shotgun by countout. Van Dam made the comment backstage that it would be like Bret Hart losing to one of their job guys. Several WWF officials, Gerald Brusco in particular, found it to be insulting that Van Dam would compare himself to Bret, and there were lots of complaints about Van Dam thinking he was a bigger star than he really is. It has nearly killed the WWF ECW deal completely. And this incident would stick with Van Dam for years, it felt like, for the WWF.
He's right, though.
He was right. Come on here. We've watched
the Shotgun. It's fucking...
The guy that was fuming with Rockabilly.
Yeah, it's just stupid.
WCW's big surprise for this Monday probably won't be a definite until the last minute. WCW also attempted to bring in Jose Lothario as a surprise for the Las Vegas Nitro, just to get people talking about Sean making the jump, but it didn't materialise. So that's quite funny. So, a big Nitro here on June 30th, the final one of this quarter. We'll get to Raw first. The show was built around the Paul Bearer secret and The Undertaker's response. Both interviews did spike the ratings. Bearer revealed that The Undertaker set his house on fire and murdered his parents. Taker denied it and threatened to kill Paul Bearer unless he told the truth. Bearer insisted it was the truth because Kane had told him and Kane was still alive. So here is the seeds for what would become. And at first, this sounds every bit as ridiculous as Papa Shango did.
Yeah, off the back of this 1 week, you would fear where this is going to go. But we talk about wrestling as a soap opera, and this is very much soap opera 101.
You know, and hearing the conception of this idea, it's just... roll your eyes, contrived bullshit you think it's going to be in there.
Yeah. I think even now, even just hearing it there, though, knowing how it pans out and knowing that it's not, you know...
It would work for what
knowing that it would work, even still, I hear that and wince slightly.
Los Barriquas also debuts on this show. And gets into a brawl with DOA and The Nation, which police have to come and break up. The brawl between the two Stampede teams, the main team, the Heart Foundation and the Babyfaces, ends the show. Over on Nitro, the big Nitro in Las Vegas, Kevin Nash destroys Rey Mysterio, repeatedly powerbombing him after the match until Conan comes out to join in and joins the NWO. This will lead to Rey having time off to rest his knee, which has been injured for a long, long time. Raven debuts, sitting in the crowd here. They're trying to do an interview with Mike Tenay, trying to talk to Raven, but Raven doesn't say a word, doesn't let on anything that's happening. The main event is Savage, Hall, and Nash against Luger, the Giant, and Diamond Dallas Page. Hogan appears and hits Luger and Giant with a title belt, and the rest of the NWO come out. Savage gives Page three elbows off the top, Sting comes from the ceiling, and the NWO bails at the sight of Sting. So again, to what you mentioned, Kieran, in terms of giving a babyface true shine, they bail at the sight of Sting. They don't even wait to get their ass kicked, they just head out. Raven jumps the barricade and Kurt Hennig comes out while all this was going on as the show goes off the air. Ratings for this week. Nitro does a 3.3 to Raw's 2.5. You may have noticed there that there was really no big surprise. Raven was not obviously supposed to be the big surprise. Kurt Hennig was already scheduled. Here's an interesting note. WCW's big surprise was originally supposed to be Mike Tyson. And Tyson was in the building and they made the decision not to use him.
Oh!
The decision was made that it was in everyone's best interest for him not to be around because the show was in Las Vegas and 2 days earlier he'd bitten Holyfield's ear off, so he was at the height of his notoriety. They had him in the fucking building and they didn't use Mike Tyson with all the mainstream attention that would have got based off that.
Now that's a shucky ducky quack quack if I've ever heard one. Well, there you go. That little hidden nugget right there, was what changed everything.
If they had have used him, do you think he would have been used later on in 98?
Who knows, because the novelty would have been gone. Yeah. He would have done WCW. Would they have wanted the Tyson Association?
Exactly. Wow.
Probably not, because he would have, you know, pardon the expression, but it probably would have come across as sloppy seconds, frankly.
It really would.
You know, the genie's already out the bottle at that point. You've used him at the real peak of his notoriety. There was still the notorious nature when you get to WrestleMania, but by that point it's subsiding a bit and he is gearing up for his boxing return at that stage. Whereas here, he really is the sort of the outlaw, the renegade of the boxing community.
He's the most talked about person in the world while this Nitro happens. Yeah. He's there backstage at the show and they just say, you know what, nah.
Particularly given the mindset of a company who will do almost anything to pop a rating as well. You know, when you marry that up with it, it completely boggles the mind that they didn't do it.
Exactly, I was going to say, exact same phrase, boggles the mind. I can't believe it.
How much of this do you think is right to that thing we heard before about Ted Turner not wanting was like ass and down and not wanting maybe this product to be associated with negative connotations, and Tyson obviously had plenty of negative connotations anyway, and then was even more so after 2 days previously biting off Evander's ear.
That is probably the only logical explanation I can think for.
Yeah, the fact that it was in Las Vegas doesn't make a difference to me.
No, I don't think
that's
so
not
either.
Enough.
I don't think Vegas is a factor at all. That's the only thing I can think that sort of the Turner family, if you like, who as a brand, you know, you think classic movies, Cartoon Network, all that sort of thing, you know, TBS, it has a very wholesome image, doesn't it? The pressure coming from a top, higher top Bischoff to not use him.
It's as you said before, Carl.
The only other way that you could completely fuck that up is if it was just absolute pure arrogance on their part. Of this, I can't state that this is rational thinking by any thought, but they just thought around and just thought, you know what, I think we got this one. I think we can save this for another week or something, no. Or maybe just to the point where they just thought, oh, I don't think we need him.
No, I totally agree.
It has to be ego, arrogance, everything.
I totally agree. It's Bischoff looking in. He's thinking, okay, he's not seeing how huge it could be.
Yeah.
And he's weighing up the pros and cons. He's going to get stick from above because he's, you know, he ultimately answers to someone else. So for him, pros and cons are, well, we don't need it. Yeah. We're going to win anyway. We're comfortable. But God, fucking hell.
It's like imagine the business would be completely different if that one decision hadn't been made. But, so
yeah,
weird.
Yeah. I mean, I can understand the arrogance argument, and you can, it's Bischoff, you can completely see it. Mm. But by the same token then, knowing, you know, the time that you're in, and it's a war, if you're Bischoff, even if you don't want to use him there, why not tie him down to some sort of written agreement? Get something in place so that you don't risk him going to the WWF. Because surely that would weigh up in his thinking. You know, if we don't get something, you know, signed, sealed and delivered, and the WWF finds out that we were going to use him, and we haven't, they can use him and get all the glory that goes with it.
They probably thought that Vince wouldn't be able to afford the
exactly what I was going to say, for
the short term. From what they were, gonna, I just can't believe they didn't bring him out in an NWO shirt.
That's exactly. Even just for a cameo, a quick cameo.
That's and yeah, no way would he have been in DX after being in NWO. No fucking way.
Yeah, exactly.
Holy shit!
Even just show him in the audience watching the show.
Yeah,
anything.
That's not what. Well, that's the seeds of their own misfortune, I think. There isn't it. Would you say they planted them or they didn't plant them? That's where they failed. You know, it's just like, fuck me. That's the secret tide turner there.
It's a fact that this has been completely lost to history that fascinates me as much as anything else. Like, how is that not known that he was actually there to do it?
And it's funny because Bischoff, on those Monday Night War series they've got on the network now, does reference about when one of the fellow executives or whoever it was comes into his office and tells him that they're getting Tyson for WrestleMania. He always references, damn, I knew we were in trouble then.
Bullshit, if you knew that, you'd have used him to start with.
But that's the point I want to trying to get to
before you slaughter me there.
The point I'm trying to make is, it's funny how Bischoff references that and thinks and likes to say, geez, I knew we were in trouble, they were onto something, but he never references the notion that he had him in the palm of his hands to use.
To try and run the scenario, if they actually did use Tyson WCW, would they have done as good a job as WWF? Would he have been as well utilised, do you think?
No, that's not the point. It would have been a throwaway one-week thing. It would have been a throwaway one-week thing with him probably in an NWO
shirt.
For Sports Centre highlights.
It would have been
Rodman. It would probably be less than that. But that's not the point we're talking, is it? So, yeah.
If they only use him for 1 week, so what? They've used him and the WWF hasn't.
Yeah,
exactly. It's all about stopping the competition. It's not about how well they utilise Tyson. It's just about another black eye for the WWF.
Kind of interestingly, of this timeline that we've gone through so far and what we're going to go through for the rest of these years, it's interesting that the most vital jump from one company to the other was the one most of us here didn't know about, and it was Mike Tyson and not, you know, the Radicals or Jericho or Big Show or whatever. It was
Brett.
Mike or Brett. It was Mike Tyson.
But it's all in hindsight, and who's to say if he'd done one show for WCW, never gone to WWF.
Yeah.
Steve Austin leading up to the title and getting the title, it maybe nothing would have been different in the long run anyway. Maybe it would have taken a slightly longer. It wouldn't have kicked off at such a great speed for Austin, but it still would have built up over time. Who's to say?
Backstage turmoil, on-screen turmoil, plans changing, ratings eventually ending up pretty much where they've been for the entire quarter, to be quite honest.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of an in-ring product, WCW haven't done anything particularly noteworthy in this period, from a pure in-ring perspective. And it sort of strikes me that they are, as we've said before, in this holding pattern. It's this period to me, and the way you've sort of dropped these little tidbits in, some of which we knew, some of which we certainly didn't. This period's all about what's happening behind the camera.
Yeah.
And it's all about the chaos that's ensuing in both companies to varying degrees and to varying impacts on what they're portraying on TV. I'm just relieved that we can, on the next one, put this chaos behind us and look forward to a more relaxing and more calm period.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just pretty much just 3 months of them throwing shit at a wall and getting most of it on their trousers. Really, it's just...
Sorry, is this Brett and Sean in the bathroom again?
This is just everybody. Sean, Brett probably primarily, but so they have these two guys, these two baby faces in Sting and Austin that are hot, but it's just right now they're not utilising them at their best. I mean, you can argue with the long game with Sting. Austin, though, he's still kind of treading water. There's nothing really kind of gripping because of Bret Hart with the injury as well. You know, there's nothing much that Austin can do in terms of his work with Bret, and Sean's making things harder as well. It's just a real kind of tricky 3 month period of where, besides a couple of individual moments here, there's not really anything to jizz over. I guess we're kind of having to wait a little bit longer to get some really classic stuff.
Just slightly contradict what you said then, Chase. Through all the inconsistencies, especially on the WWF side, the one consistent thing, and due to the opportunity given by the absence of others, is 3 or 4 brilliant little segments of Steve Austin week in, week out. And even though loads of people aren't watching yet, those who are buying his t-shirts, the chaos probably created the opportunity for him. He's still, even though he hasn't got a real focus with when he had his title match of Taker and stuff, he's still focused on the Hart Foundation, and that the formation of the Hart Foundation in this 3 month period really massively for me contributed to the growth of Austin as a face from the US side of things. And obviously going to the Calgary Stampede, we see that the flip side of it, but it's in terms of really solidifying him as a baby face. I thought during this period he became noticeably hotter during the course of it, and I think it's the association with working with Bret and the Hart Foundation.
I want to thank everybody for listening. This has been a hell of a show. We will be back next week with a show we're going to call McMyth Busting. We're going to talk about WWE's built-in philosophies, elements of their revisionist history, and ideas about wrestlers or the business that Vince McMahon's put forward over the years that we strongly disagree with or feel are the most absurd, and of course, why. We want your nominations for the McMyth that you'd like to bust as well, so send those over to scgradio@hotmail.com, and we'll be sure to read them on the show next week. For G. John Chase,
I am a real American, fight for the rights of every man. Well, every man, Hogan. Every man.
For Carl Jones.
What you talking about, Hogan?
For Kieran O'Rourke.
Remember, folks, beerbase.co.uk.
I am Liam O'Rourke, and we are out of here. We're talking softball. From Maine to San Diego, talking softball. Manningly and Canseco, Ken Griffey's grotesquely swollen jaw, Steve Sachs and his running with the law. We're talking Homer, Ozzie and the Straw. We're talking softball, from Maine to San Diego, talking softball. Mattingly and Canseco, Ken Griffey's grotesquely swollen jaw, Steve Sachs and his running with the law. We're talking Homer, Ozzie and the Straw.